charming and a lovely surprise from Philippe Jordan and Jean-Yves Thibaudet. You might have heard Thibaudet saying just there at the beginning that they were playing together at the piano, the Jardin Féerie, the Enchanted Garden from Ravel's Mother Goose Suite. They even had a little comedy routine going at the very beginning of that. He was slightly baffled about what the laughter and applause was about. Philippe Jordan making his way to the podium and then joining Thibaudet, inviting him to join him at the piano for that. Lovely stuff. And if you like that, there are more piano duets to look forward to at the proms on Thursday week on the 5th of September. There's a Schubert late night prom from Imogen Cooper, who's a featured artist at this year's BBC proms, and Paul Lewis. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to BBC Radio 3 live at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall. The Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester, or Youth Orchestra. That was the first half of their prom, Wagner and Ravel. In the second half, they're going to be performing Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. Here, it's time for the interval. So on Radio 3, we're now going to take a little flight of fancy for 20 minutes, imagining ourselves inside a fictional version of Shostakovich's life. Imagine that he's at home. It's the early hours of the morning on a day that will unfold dramatically in an extract taken from the novel The Conductor by Sarah Quigley.
It seemed he'd been waiting all his life for the knock at the door. He heard it dimly when he slept, tapping on the surface of his dreams. He heard it when he was working, in the urgent roll of timpani or the sharp plucking of pizzicato strings. And he heard it in the sound of his own footsteps when he walked the streets, so that even when hurrying, he could never escape it. Shostakovich. Shostakovich. Was someone calling his name? He struggled to open his eyes. The room was blurred at the edges of his vision, with a bright glare in the centre where he knew the work table to be. Nina? He reached blindly for his glasses, patting the mattress and then the low stool beside the bed. It was an effort to lift his arm. His fingers felt limp and without their usual strength. He'd worked late and eaten nothing over the past 24 hours except for some hard rye bread soaked in tea. The good thing about hunger and extreme tiredness was that they alleviated fear. The sound that woke him. Had it been the knock? If he were taken now, he would almost be relieved. His fingers found the steel arms of his glasses, then the reassuring curve of the rims. He pushed aside the rough grey blanket, supposedly a privilege, but even privilege could make your skin itch. With his glasses on, the wavering whiteness shrank to nothing. The shabby walls stood back. The room held its breath. Now he wasn't sure what he'd heard. Someone in the street? Or simply the rap-rap of the loose window in its frame? Nina? He swung his legs over the edge of the bed, ran his hand through his hair, shuffled to the door. But when he looked cautiously into the outer room, he found it was empty. Downstairs, in the communal kitchen, a naked light bulb. He bumped his head on it, as always, and swore. The reek of cleaning fluid, cabbage, and cheap cutlets made him nauseous. He clamped his fingers over his nose and breathed ostentatiously through his mouth as he mixed his porridge, though there was no one there to watch his theatrics. He was thankful for this. He'd never liked talking much before midday. As he leaned on the table, wiping a smear of dust from his glasses, he heard a noise behind him. Glancing backwards, he saw a cracked pair of overshoes, a skinny pair of ankles.
Ah, Mr. Shostakovich, I could tell from the footsteps bumbling over my ceiling that it was you.
Irina Barinova. Very good morning to you.
Good morning? Is it still morning?
She rummaged inside her dress.
Ah, in fact, Mr. Shostakovich, it is already afternoon.
He watched silently as old Irina Barinova displayed, with slightly shaking hands, her father's gold watch, a reminder of better days.
Goodness, is it really afternoon? No wonder our stove had gone out by the time I woke up.
Irina shoveled the heavy watch and chain back into her sprigged cotton dress, and again, with a lurch of his stomach, he thought,
"Where's Nina?" "You've been burning the midnight oil, I expect. What it must be to have genius."
Now that she'd exposed him as a shameless bohemian, a no-good father and a husband who let the family stove go cold, she became flattering. It was all part of the routine. Irina looked at him, almost coyly, from under white eyelashes.
"To think that Dmitri Shostakovich should be living in my house. Leningrad's most famous son living here, under the roof of my dear deceased father."
Shostakovich ducked his head.
"All this," she waved a twig-like arm, "once it all belonged to my father, from the attic to the basement."
"Yes, I know. You've told me that 365 days of the year for as many years as a donkey's ears are long." He stabbed the porridge with the wooden spoon.
"Once we had maids and cooks. Now it's a house full of strangers."
Shostakovich stared at the porridge, willing bubbles to appear.
"Speaking of maids, where is your Fenya? I haven't seen her for days."
"Fenya is visiting her parents." He whipped the pan off the stove. Suddenly, undercooked oats seemed appealing. "Therefore, I make my own porridge."
"Well, what about Nina? How is dear Nina?"
Shostakovich dropped the spoon and porridge splattered over his shirt front.
"I saw her going out this morning with the children. I believe they were carrying travelling bags. Perhaps they're also visiting relations."
Shostakovich skirted around the table, knocking his head once more on the light bulb. For a small person, Irina Barinova was remarkably adept at blocking escape routes. "You really must excuse me." He gestured with his saucepan. "Nothing worse than cold porridge for breakfast."
"Breakfast?"
Irina raised her wizened hand once more to her breast.
"My father was washed and shaved and had taken a turn around the park before his breakfast, which was served in the Red Room at 8 o'clock sharp."
He took the stairs two at a time. The empty apartment was no longer unsettling. It was bliss. Standing by the old wooden table, he shoveled the porridge straight from the pan into his mouth. He poured cold water onto strong, cold tea and threw in half a spoonful of honey that fell like a stone to the bottom of the glass. God, he was starving. He was thirsty. He had to start thinking about work. Halfway through his second bowl, he saw the note lying on the floor. It was smeared with dust from being pushed under the door. But his name was legible, written in a familiar hand. He walked to the window to read it, continuing to shovel lukewarm mush into his mouth. Put down the bowl, the spoon with twin clatters, gulped the last dregs of tea, pulled on his boots, hat with ear flaps, a patched coat, and left the house. On the bench at the corner of Zamkovaya and Klenovaya streets sat a large, shaggy bear. Shostakovich approached, a little warily, from behind.
"You're late," said the bear. "Very late."
I overslept. Then Arina Barinova cornered me in the kitchen. I thought I'd never get away. He swallowed unhappily and sat down beside Solotinsky, who was bundled in a shapeless fur coat fit for a tramp. Brushing up on language number 18. He looked at the book of Georgian grammar in Solotinsky's huge hand. "Your loyalty to our leader puts the rest of us to shame."
"Language number 3, said Solotinsky, winking. "I felt a little malcontent today. Experienced a slight frisson at this morning's news."
Shostakovich peered more closely at the book. A light blue cover concealed a dull grey one. Inside, there was French text. "You're a masterful dissembler." Solotinsky shrugged, looked around at the high glinting windows, the screen of trees around the park.
"We both know that dissemblers live longer than dissidents."
The sun was as hard as nails, and Shostakovich pulled his collar up around his ears. "If you've got something to tell me, let's go somewhere less exposed." The drinking house was dark after the white glare outside. Solotinsky headed for the corner table, and Shostakovich followed, stumbling over a chair.
"You look a little under the weather. Rough night?"
"A rough 3 nights. No sleep until dawn."
"Back to the old regime, then."
Solotinsky gestured to the boy at the bar.
"My poor, tortured friend."
"I only want tea. I ate breakfast under an hour ago."
"And what of that?"
"Well, all right. Perhaps just one drink." It was cozy, sitting there with his old friend, feeling his hands thaw and the warmth of vodka in his stomach. Cozy, seemingly like any other day. Nonetheless, something wasn't right. "I haven't had a bowel movement for days," he reflected. "Perhaps that's why I'm feeling strange."
"Wait till you hear the news. That'll make you go, all right."
"News?" Shostakovich had forgotten, what with the cold and the blinding sun and the feeling that, back in the apartment, he'd left something unattended to. Solotinsky leaned forward, dwarfing the small round table. Raising his magnificent eyebrows, he took a mouthful of vodka and swished it loudly about in his cheeks. "What?" Solotinsky touched the side of his nose in a conspiratorial manner.
"My tailor told me when I went to him this morning. Apparently, last week, Herr Lehrmann cancelled a large order. The next day, Herr Ziegler did the very same thing."
Shostakovich shook his head. "Two Germans cancelled orders for suits, so?"
"Two German diplomats. Two German diplomats cancelled at short notice with Yuri Davydenko, whose waiting list is as long as the River Volga."
"You're sure of this? Absolutely sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. I checked it out myself. You don't think I'd take Davydenko's word for anything more important than the cut of my trousers, do you?"
Solotinsky sounded weary, as if Shostakovich were one of his more idiotic musicology students.
"After we'd ascertained the measurement of my inside leg, I decided the Lehmans were in need of some freshly baked bread. Right away. He paused for a mouthful of vodka. When I got there with their complimentary breakfast, I rang their doorbell. And? They'd gone. And I don't just mean for a Sunday stroll. The apartment is empty.
How do you know?
I looked through the keyhole, of course.
Shostakovich glanced round. The room was empty, except for the pointy-nosed Mikhail Druskin, bent double over his notebook, no doubt slaughtering the Philharmonic's recent performance of Prokofiev's orchestral suite.
So, the Germans are evacuating their own?
That's my interpretation. One can only hope that I'm wrong.
I need to pee. Shostakovich pushed back his chair and strode to the dingy bathroom. He stood facing the urinals, staring at the long, familiar crack across the porcelain. In the past, he'd seen this as a horizon over a wheat field, or the thin grey line from the funnel of a steamer. Now he was so agitated that his glasses steamed up, and he saw nothing at all. Solotinsky shuffled up beside him and turned the water on full.
Although this is bad news for us, it's not entirely unexpected. There have been rumours for months, from London, from Washington, and also from within. Of course, Stalin doesn't want to hear, nor to see, the possibility that he's been taken for a ride by Hitler doesn't sit easily with his view of the world.
So he shuts his damn eyes. Shostakovich closed his own. The water. The early drinking. He was beginning to feel queasy. And the German rats run from the sinking ship, and we... Well, what are we to do?
Solotinsky shook his head.
There's nothing we can do but wait. I came to your home this morning simply to tell you what I'd found out, not to rouse you to action. As it turned out, I couldn't rouse you at all. When Dmitri Shostakovich finally sleeps, he might as well be dead. I knocked so hard, the door nearly crumbled. I thought your wife would be out chasing me away with a broom.
Nina! Shostakovich started. When I woke up, Nina was gone. It was all starting to come back to him. She threatened last night that she'd take the children, go to her parents for a few days. She was very angry.
No wonder she was angry.
Solotinsky turned off the water.
How would you like to be married to yourself, day in and day out?
He led the way back into the now half-full drinking house. Shostakovich signalled to the barkeeper for more vodka.
Nina isn't easy herself. She seems incapable of understanding that sometimes I must be left alone to work.
Sometimes, be honest. Have you been working 24-hour or 48-hour stints this week?
The latter. But I can't stop now, not possibly, not until I get down the outline.
He stared into his empty glass and saw the whole of the previous evening there. Raised voices, slammed doors, little Galina crying, and the uncertain, insistent melody in his head.
The English Poets Project? My God, Dmitri. Most men would give their eye teeth to be married to the beautiful Nina, and you shut her out for romances of a musical kind, for Raleigh, Burns, and Shakespeare.
Nonetheless, Solotinsky gave him a reassuring slap on the shoulder.
Nina never stays away long. You know she finds you irresistible.
Solotinsky raised first his eyebrows and then his brimming glass.
to music and marital harmony. May they one day coexist.
To thinking slowly and writing fast, countered Shostakovich, gulping his vodka. Well, there's no one waiting for me at home. If I'm to live like a bachelor for the next day or two, I guess I can have another.
Three vodkas later, and the room was loud with voices and laughter. Even Druskin, who was rarely happy, had the satisfied look of a critic who'd honed a hatchet job to perfection. As they left, Solotinsky boomed out a greeting to him, while Shostakovich sneaked a quick glance at the open notebook. "Pretentious," he read. "Angular. Melodies limper than a wet handkerchief." Druskin, noticing his interest, slammed the book shut. "Oh, come on," said Shostakovich. "Whatever sins Prokofiev may be accused of, you can't deny he has a rare gift for melody." Druskin shrugged.
"Unfortunately for Sergei Prokofiev, you're not the one writing the review."
Shostakovich stared into his dry, grey face. "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle."
Druskin looked nonplussed.
"Philo of Alexandria," said Solotinsky briskly as he pushed through the door into the chilly bright light.
Solotinsky turned up the collar of his suit jacket.
"Are you feeling quite well?" He pulled on his fur overcoat. "I could have sworn I heard you defending one Mr. Prokofiev."
"Nonetheless, he's one of us, and we composers must unite against the enemy."
"Now you're using the language of war. Go home."
Solotinsky clasped his hand, kissed him on both cheeks, and warned him to take great care. Shostakovich turned to go, and then turned back.
"Do you know the worst thing about all this German fraternizing we've had to put up with?"
"No. What?"
Solotinsky's query floated on a vodka breeze. "That we've had to endure so many years of strategic Wagner," said Shostakovich. And he marched away.
Karl Prekop was reading from the novel The Conductor by Sarah Quigley, and the producer was Duncan Minchell. Well, that was fictional Shostakovich. Welcome back to reality, where we're about to hear Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. The Royal Albert Hall here, live at the BBC Proms, is filling up with members of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra.
My name is Alice Weber, and I come from Germany. I play viola.
And how long have you been with Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra?
Since 2010. I'm quite an old member.
Are they very strong friendships that you make in the orchestra?
Yeah, very strong, for sure. We spend so much time together. It's a very intense month most of the time that we spend together, and all day, all night.
And over your years with the orchestra, you must have worked with several conductors.
For sure, yes. This is actually the second time I work with Philip Jordan. He's great, I really like him a lot. And it's interesting to see how much I learned in between these two tours and how much I get from him now and how much I remember from back then. And every conductor is very different, and we for sure learn a lot.
That was violist Alice Weber from Germany talking to me earlier on. I met several members of the orchestra. They're absolutely fantastic, so full of energy, incredibly hardworking. And they also do seem to have quite a lot of fun together. Well, Philippe Jordan, whom Alice Weber mentioned there, is with the orchestra for the fourth time on their summer tour. First of all, he was with them in 2006. And he talks to us now about what it's like working with them.
It's a great experience. It's my fourth tour with this orchestra, and every time it's even more gratifying because it's not only the energy and the passion and the fire and the love which they give in their playing, but as well for a conductor, it's amazing that they're just so open for everything, for ideas, and this is something very, very gratifying. I think Shostakovich in general is very, very good for young players because everything, all musical elements are there with Shostakovich. It's very brilliant, it's very clear, and of course the energy is very important. Shostakovich, sometimes in his simplicity, seems at first a little bit banal. And on the second side, it's incredibly deep and profound. And you have to really fight for each note. And if it's just like the end of Shostakovich 5, the strings are repeating an A like for 1 million times. But you have to fight for each one. And that's something where such unfatigable energy as young players is amazing. And even then, at the end, they still managed to do a crescendo on that.
So, the crescendo to look forward to at the very end of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. On stage now to conduct the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester or Youth Orchestra is Filip Jordan. The applause began here in the Royal Albert Hall, even before Philip Jordan had brought down his baton in front of the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester Youth Orchestra, the finest players in Europe under the age of 26, coming together for that bright and incisive performance of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. That was the piece of music that saved Shostakovich's life, so to speak, after the Pravda article which condemned his Lady Macbeth and the disaster of his Fourth Symphony really rehabilitated him in the eyes of the Soviet authorities. And as Philip Jordan was saying to us earlier on, that Shostakovich, in fact, so much of his music really fantastic for these young players to tackle, given their youthful energy and vitality, and that they can summon the energy for that extraordinary crescendo right at the end. That last swell of applause was for the leader of the orchestra, the Russian Yulia Kopilova. There are 21 nationalities represented on stage in this orchestra: Russia, France, the Netherlands, Austria, Lithuania, Germany, Spain, Greece, Switzerland, Italy, Finland, Belgium, Denmark, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Estonia, Poland, Great Britain, Portugal, Slovenia, and even one player from Israel. Great to see the orchestra back here at the Proms. They gave a fantastic concert last year. Philip Jordan was with them last at the Proms in 2006, at which they performed Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony. Now cheers for individual section leaders of the wind and brass. Philip Jordan bringing each one of them to their feet. Really, really busy summer for these young players. They've been on tour, first of all at the Salzburg Festival, then in Bolzano. Just last night they were in Amsterdam at the Concertgebouw. And as I mentioned earlier on, they got stuck in a tunnel just outside St. Pancras on the Eurostar. So we're lucky they even made it here at all to the Proms. And on Monday, they're off to Dresden for more music making. As the applause continues here at the Albert Hall tonight, I shall bid you a good night and hand you on to Katrina Young in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore-Peach. And you might well want to revisit some of that, or indeed all of it. There's plenty of time, though. It'll be on the Radio 3 website for you to listen to for the next 7 days. And the whole Prom has a second outing next weekend. It'll be on Radio 3 next Sunday afternoon, a week tomorrow, starting at 2 o'clock.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Wagner's Parsifal. Lars Klaverman, John Tomlinson and Katharina Dalyman star in Wagner's final epic drama of renunciation and redemption. Mark Elder conducts the Halle in Parsifal. Tomorrow afternoon on BBC Radio 3 at 4:30.
Well, being such an epic work, Parsifal does provide us with the only prom tomorrow. But Monday's quite different. Three proms on offer to start the week. The first is at lunchtime with the Signum Quartet playing Elizabeth McConchy and Brahms in Proms Chamber Music. And then at around tea time, the Light Organ Prom. Richard Hill's playing music by, among others, Eric Coates, Arthur Sullivan and Billy Mayle on the mighty instrument at the Royal Albert Hall. That's at 4:30 on Monday. Well, I couldn't immediately lay my hands on anything played by Richard Hill, so instead I thought we'd hear the organ he'll be performing on. This is Simon Preston playing in 2006, soon after the Albert Hall organ was restored. It's a medley and it's called The Brothers Gershwin. The Brothers Gershwin, arranged by Howard Cable and played by Simon Preston on the organ of the Royal Albert Hall, which will be in action again for the light organ prom on Monday afternoon. On that occasion, in the capable hands and feet, I suppose, of the organist Richard Hills. Well, we were listening earlier to the wonderful Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra. Before the interval, they were joined by Jean-Yves Thibaudet for Ravel's G major concerto. By the time Ravel wrote that around 1930, he hadn't produced anything for solo piano since the start of the First World War, nothing, in fact, since his Tombeau de Couperin. These are a bit earlier than that, two minuets he wrote at the turn of the century.
Thank you.
two minuets by Ravel. The pianist was Stephen Osborne. Well, I've already mentioned Parsifal, the prom tomorrow beginning at 4:30. There is, though, another opera at the proms this week when Glyndebourne comes to the Royal Albert Hall with their festival production of Britten's Billy Budd. It stars Jacques Imbrilo as Billy and Mark Padmore as Captain Vere. Sir Andrew Davis conducts, and it starts at 7:00 on Tuesday. And here's some Britten now. In rather lighter mood, the tenor is Jamie McDougall, the pianist Malcolm Martineau.
A bachelor, I lived all alone and worked at the weaver's trade. And the only thing that I ever did wrong was to woo a fair young maid. I wooed her in the winter time and in the summer too. And the only thing I did that was wrong was to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew. One night she came to my bedside when I lay fast asleep. She laid her head upon my bed and she began to weep. She sighed, she cried, she damn near died. She said, "What shall I do?" So I hauled her into bed and I covered up her head just to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew. Oh, I am a bachelor and I live with my son and we work at the weaver's trade. And every single time that I look into his eyes, he reminds me of the fair young maid. He reminds me of the winter time and of the summer too, and of the many, many times that I held her in my arms, just to keep her from the foggy, foggy dew. Flaxen-headed cowboy, as simple as may be, and next a merry plowboy, I whistled overly. But now a saucy footman, I strut in worsted lace, and soon I'll be a butler, and weigh my jolly face. When steward I'm promoted, I'll slip the tradesman's bill, my master's coffers empty, my pockets for to fill. When morning in my chariot, so great a man I'll be, so great a man, so great a man, so great a man I'll be. Oh, forget the little plowboy who whistled over me. Oh, forget the little plowboy who whistled over me. I'll bivolt at elections, and when I've made the path, I'll stand poll for the parliament, and then vote in myself. Whatever's good for me, sir, I never will oppose. When all my eyes are sold off, why then I'll sell my nose. I'll joke, harangue, and paragraph with speeches charm the ear. And when I'm tired on my legs, then I'll sit down a peer. In court or city honour, so great a man I'll be. So great a man, so great a man, so great a man I'll be.
Plowboy, and before it, The Foggy Foggy Dew and The Sally Gardens, three of Britain's many folk song arrangements. Jamie McDougall was the tenor, accompanied by Malcolm Martineau. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 10 o'clock, and this week's edition of Here and Now is presented by Robert Warby, with a little bit of help from tonight's featured composer.
The world of music is very conservative and sometimes very boring. And needs some pepper.
Hello. Continuing this month's theme of modernism on Here and Now, we're focusing tonight on the Argentinian-German composer Maurizio Cargo. We've just heard him deliver one of his typically quirky thoughts about music in general, and we'll be hearing more from him throughout the programme. The pepper tonight is his extended work, The Pieces of the Compass Rose, composed between 1988 and 1994. Lasting about an hour and three quarters, there are eight pieces, one for each of the eight cardinal directions found on a navigational compass. The London Sinfonietta performed all eight pieces at the South Bank Centre in June, and Here and Now were there to record it. During rehearsals, I met the conductor, Thierry Fischer, and asked him what drew him to this work.
I was immediately attracted by the orchestration. It's a salon orchestra. When you hear the ensemble playing in tutti, you think, oh, lovely, we are going to hear great waltzes and little tango and, you know, one or two marches because the percussion is so huge. So it's very typical Kagel, who is using a very traditional material to write really not traditionally. I loved the idea.
Could you say something about the unusual sounds that we hear, especially in the percussion? There's all kinds of strange stuff going on. We hear cushions being played. We hear water being poured. We hear branches being waved around.
Yeah, the percussion is a tour de force, really, because I think he has like 45 instruments to play during the whole piece. And that's where you see the good composers is always used, not for an effect, but for development of something which is already happening or preparing the development of something which will happen. So it's always to add a character or an atmosphere to a character. So it's very, very, very well done. Always musical, always has sense, and is always attractive as a listener if you are in the hall. I mean, people listening on Radio 3 will not have this, but you are as fascinated at looking at the orchestra as listening to the orchestra.
So then, we'll hear four of the pieces of the Compass Rose in the first half, starting with East, and I'll name them all as we go along. And we'll also hear some of Cargill's own thoughts about life, the universe and everything before each piece, including some from a telephone conversation I had with him not long before his death in 2008. Because after all, these eight pieces present Cargill's musical ideas about these different compass points and parts of the world, as heard through his ears. They're fictional inventions.
Playing with reality and fiction is, for me, very important all my life.
So there's the idea that in your pieces there is something of reality and something of fantasy.
Yeah.
East.
I remember when I was 12, I invented for me the technique of 12 tone without nothing about Schoenberg. It was something in the air. And intellectuals know this very, very well. Something which is necessary can happen by spontaneously generation, something like that.
South.